I'm joined on the phone by Dylan, a member of the Jeffrey Lures Defense Network. Dylan, you there?
Yeah, I'm here. Thanks for having me.
All right, great. Who is Jeffrey Lures?
Okay, well, Jeffrey Lures is a 26-year-old anarchist and a political prisoner currently serving a 22-year, 8-month sentence in Oregon State Penitentiary in Salem, Oregon. Jeff was arrested in June 15, 2000, for with a co-defendant named Craig Marshall for burning three SUVs at a car dealership in Eugene, Oregon, and spent 1 year waiting trial and then was sentenced to the 22-year, 8-month in June 11, 2001.
And why has he done this? And tell me a little bit about Jeff's history.
Sure. Well, Jeff's history is that he's from Southern California. He moved up to Oregon in the late 90s, got involved in a lot of different struggles up there, including forest defense and things like that. Jeff was the first tree sitter out at the Fall Creek Tree Village in the Willamette National Forest, and they established the tree village on April 20th, 1998, and so far, that land has been pretty much saved. That timber sale has been shrunk, and so far has not been cut. And Free was one of the first tree sitters out there, and spent I think about 2.5 months up in the trees. But Jeff was also involved in a lot of the efforts that activists engage in town in Eugene, including like food not bombs and self defense training and things like that, as well as the anti globalization movement. So I guess on June 16, 2000, Jeff and his co-defendant Critter, who's Craig Marshall, basically lit this fire at the Joe Romania car dealership in Eugene, Oregon. And apparently at the time, the Eugene Police Department were following them, about six undercover cars, and they arrested them, in the neighboring town of Springfield, claimed that there was like a car taillight out and pulled them over illegally, and then searched the car against their wishes and found some fuel and different pieces of an incendiary device. So Jeff and Craig were, sent to jail, and a week later were given attempted arson charges from an incident that took place at an oil company in the Whitaker neighborhood called Tyree Oil, I think about a month and a half prior. So all in all, they were faced with like 13 different charges.
If Jeff was active in the Eugene community, what prompted him to take this sort of action with Craig Marshall to burn some SUVs at a car dealership?
Well, I think that, from what Jeff has written, he says that he got very frustrated with the forms of protest and sort of state-sanctioned protest, like hopping from protest to protest and asking government leaders to actually address the issues. In Eugene, it's quite frustrating. You have what's regarded as a very progressive population that's just totally addled with apathy and sort of, hippy-dippy crap, basically. And so you have, like, this small, you had a very small and active anarchist scene there for some time, and people were really frustrated with the inability to stop some of the logging and things like that. And so he chose climate change. He chose, destroying the SUVs because I think the issue of climate change is very close to his heart. He spent his years as a child in Southern California basically plagued by smog and living in a kind of degraded environment down there. And I think that he thought that was a really important issue. So that's what drove him to burn the SUVs.
You've talked about examples where he's tried to organize some positive things in his community, such as food not bombs and self-defense for women. How about his passion about SUVs and climate change? Had he tried to write letters? Had he tried to organize protests?
Well, I think Jeff was involved. I don't know the specifics of the, the SUVs and whatnot in regards to that, but I know that he was involved in lobbying efforts to protect the local forest out there. And I think what originally brought him to Eugene was, I think, a position with one of the sort of mainstream environmental groups. And, I think he liked what he saw and he stayed there and decided to take direct action as opposed to, sort of mediated forms of activism. I mean, anyone that's been in Eugene, it's probably a lot like Santa Cruz. You have a lot of these congressional representatives and whatnot that are, they're all pro-environmental, pro-eco, but then, the destruction of the environment up there and the forest just continues. It just keeps going and keeps going, no matter how progressive the local population is. I think Jeff got frustrated, and I think that, you know, you were playing the video before, and he was talking about his sense of frustration and how, you know, people need to take direct action in their lives to address these things, as opposed to, you know, begging government representatives to do it for them.
And so where is Jeff now? What's his current state?
Well, Jeff is approaching his fifth year of incarceration. He's at Oregon State Penitentiary in Salem, Oregon. It's a maximum security prison, and he's currently housed on the unit in the jail reserved for people serving life sentences, which is kind of odd. Jeff has been given security threat group status, which is another way of saying they perceive him as a gang member and that he's a member of the quote-unquote anarchy gang, which is pretty much likening him to, you know, being a white supremacist or whatnot. And that classification as security threat group status basically gives him a lot more scrutiny in his mail, his incoming and outgoing mail, and what he's able to receive and where he is housed and how many hours he can be out of his cell a day and things like that. And we're in sort of the position where the Oregon State Penitentiary and Oregon Department of Corrections has a lot of power in this situation. So they're saying, well, you're an anarchist or you're in the anarchy gang, and that's that. So that's quite an injustice in itself. But Jeff is entering his fifth year of incarceration, and he's quite the active prisoner. He's not just, as they say, doing his time with his head down, but is really actively engaged in his own support. And you asked before about the Jeff's defense network, and I'll get into that. Basically, Jeff was working with a large amount of individuals, and I think we were working on different projects and all kind of geographically spread out, and so our effort to form this defense network was not a way to make a centralized body, but because we're not centralized, we're all over the place, but it was a way to sort of maybe get some more synergy in the work they were doing with him. And so there's a number of different individuals spread out throughout the U.S. and Europe, and those people are sort of involved more with the day-to-day aspects of prisoner support for Jeff.
I read about a case in Washington State. Can you tell me how that case relates to what's going on with Jeff?
Sure. There's, that basically refers to Jeff's appeal. There was a case called Blakely versus Washington, and that is a case that got appealed up to the Supreme Court level. And what it essentially did is it reined in some of the excessive sentence practices of judges, and it calls into question how judges all over the country are able to sentence individuals. Now, with Jeff's sentence, it's a whole topic we can get into, and I can explain why it's so egregious. The Blakely versus Washington case was resolved on the Supreme Court level, and that has implications for Jeff's case. It very well could have implications, which could lead to a sentence reduction outside of the bounds of his normal appeal. So it can be in addition to his appeal, we could be expecting a sentence reduction. Unfortunately, the so-called wheels of justice grind really slow, and so we are currently waiting for a court date from the Oregon Court of Appeals. There was a lot of communication when this case came out about, you know, basically every court of appeals in the country is asking the Supreme Court what the deal is and how they can go ahead. And so what they do is they use these test cases, and they have to find good cases to put forward to establish precedent. And I don't think they really regarded Jeff's case as a good case for that. So he's basically in queue waiting for his case to be before the Oregon Court of Appeals. And we have been waiting since January 13, 2002 for that appeal to take place. So it's extremely slow. The intricacies of the Blakely versus Washington case are somewhat beyond me at times. So I think people can check out, there's an organization called Families Against Mandatory Minimums, and they do great work, and they have a 4-page explanation of Blakely, as well as a number of other sentencing reform cases that have come out, and that kind of sums it up. You can easily find them on the internet just by doing a search.
Let's talk more about Jeff's sentence. Why is he facing more than 22 years behind bars? Why such what seems to be such a stiff sentence?
Well, clearly, I mean, I've done a lot of research, and I've never been able to find a sentence of arson anywhere remotely close to 21 years or 22 years and 8 months. I've been looking for cases in Oregon that are remotely close to Jeff's sentence, and it's really hard to find, except for the most egregious cases. You will find people doing 3/4 of their sentence on murder or rape, or really serious charges like that, or kidnapping, or, you know, assault, battery, things like that. But for some reason, Jeff's case, you know, they used a combination of different things to basically throw the book at him. The prosecutor in his case, Karen Tracy, who has since been pretty much forced to resign for other reasons, was asking for 540 months, which translates into something like 40-something years. And so when the judge imposed that sentence on Jeff, he almost was talking about it like it was some sort of discounted sentence. But for everyone that was in the room at the time and for everyone that has heard about that case, you know, 22 years is outrageous. So basically what happened is Jeff made the decision to have a judge trial, a bench trial, as opposed to a jury trial. And he was found guilty of, I believe it was 12 out of 13 charges. And the way the government charged him was that Jeff and Craig were basically accused of burning three sport utility vehicles. Now, normally that would be an arson charge, and it would be one arson charge. What the government did is they gave him three arson charges, and they made it a first-degree arson, which implies that there was some kind of danger to the people that were present. Now, that was kind of, I thought, debunked in court when the night watchman from the Romania Chevrolet said that he didn't feel that he was unsafe, and they played the 911 tape to the police operator, and it was clear from the recording that the night watchman wasn't in danger. And in fact, the arson specialist implied that there wasn't danger there. But for some reason, he got that first-degree enhancement, and they gave a first-degree arson charge for each SUV. Now, that the arson in the first degree is a Measure 11 crime, which means that because of a ballot Measure 11, there is a mandatory minimum sentence on the arson charge of 7 years. And that mandatory minimum says that the judge cannot mitigate that sentence and that he must sentence them to the full 7 years. So right off the bat, Jeff had three arson charges, two of which were run consecutive and one of which was run concurrent, which is a 14-year sentence. Now, short of ballot Measure 11 being reformed or the governor commuting Jeff's sentence, I don't think that we can get past those 14 years, except through some sort of appeal. Then you add on top of that all these charges, criminal mischief in the first degree, unlawful possession of a destructive device, manufacture of a destructive device, attempted arson, attempted criminal mischief, and you end up having this sentence that works out to 22 years, 8 months. It's absolutely hideous, and I'm hoping that that sentence will be halved or more by our first appeal, if not our second and third appeals. But as it stands, Jeff is serving way more time than people who rape, murder, manslaughter, and whatnot, other individuals in Oregon State or any other state for that matter. We actually have a page on our website, and I should say this right off the bat. Our website is www.freefreenow.org. There is a page that I was just referencing that says it's called Why a 23-Year Sentence. And if you go in there, you'll see not only the outline of his charges, but a whole page of comparative cases in Oregon State where you can read about how Jeff's sentencing judge sentenced a child molester to 14 years. Where you can read about famous basketball players from Portland getting suspended sentence for attempted rape and things like that. And it's really hideous because you get to see that, you know, we're not exaggerating when we say that this sentence is political and that Jeff was sentenced for being an anarchist, sentenced for being an active individual, and sentenced for basically the inability of the state to ever catch anyone associated with eco-defense actions in Oregon for the last 20 years.
What happened to his co-defendant, Craig Curtis Marshall?
Well, Craig received a deal of 5.5 years. It was a deal that was thoroughly approved by Jeff. It ended up with Critter never having to take the stand in any capacity or be interviewed or give evidence in relation to Jeff's case. So Critter was just released from jail, actually, a few months ago, and is, I believe, on parole or probation. He can be reached, actually, through the Green Anarchy people, and the email there is collective@greenanarchy.org. I understand that he's doing well and living in Oregon somewhere.
Was Jeff offered a sentence of 5.5 years?
No. Jeff was offered 13 years. And you have to understand that Jeff's case is such a benchmark. I mean, it's so absurd. It set the ceiling for like what we now conceive of as a nonviolent property crime, so to speak. But at the time, in 2000, we were looking at, you know, we were studying the sort of cases that political people get. And, you know, we recently had already experienced Rob Los Ricos Thaxton getting a 7-year charge for riot, which is absurd, But prior to that, we're looking back at like our, you know, our history, the Black Panther Party, the Black Liberation Army, the United Freedom Front. Those people were getting 25-year sentences, which was absurd. But in many ways, there was what, you know, what they considered violent crimes attached to these sentences. For Jeff, we never ever thought that it would be a 22-year sentence. We were thinking 7 years or 5 years or something like that. But no, Jeff was offered 13 years by an extremely aggressive prosecutor, and he turned it down because to take that, he would have had to admit that he was putting people's lives at risk, and that, according to Jeff and Critter, that wasn't the case. They were very clear about what they were doing, and they were used incendiary devices that were safe and sort of time-tested, and they were really into scouting the location and making sure that the night watchman was totally okay. But in court, all this, you know, went to hell. They started, you know, you played the audio before, you know, they used the word firebomb. They used the word bomb factory to describe a art workshop space, you know, a garage, basically, that a lot of people worked out of. They stopped using eco-terrorists and just started using domestic terrorists, although nowadays with Jeff, they just use terrorists because it's easier. You know, in court, the realities of the situation, the care that the two individuals took in igniting this fire was totally thrown out the window. And this is in a pre-911 environment. I can't imagine what this would be like right now.
Did Critter have to admit to putting people's lives in danger to get his sentence?
I'm not exactly sure about that. I will say that he had to plead guilty to two charges, and I believe one was criminal mischief and the other was a lesser charge, but it wasn't an arson charge.
The stated purpose was to raise awareness about global warming and the role that SUVs play in that process. Was this action successful in this regard?
I mean, it's hard for me to say. Do a lot of people know about Jeff Lurz and why he went to jail? Yeah, for sure. I think, you know, based on the amount of support that we've received throughout the world and the amount of people that are visiting our website and some of the media attention that has happened, I think there's a lot of people that are, you know, maybe taking seriously the idea that, like, wow, this person was willing to go and light these SUVs on fire. Although it might sound crazy at first because, you know, usually it's given a kind of odd spin in the media, what would drive someone to do that? So it's hard to say, would I rather Jeff be on the street right now? You know, sure, but is there a silver lining to this, you know, really horrible situation? I think there may be. It's hard to say. I mean, who really knows? But, you know, if given the choice, I would definitely choose that he would be out of jail right now.
Who are some of the people that are speaking out on behalf of Jeff?
Well, there's a lot of individuals. We launched this project of a solidarity statement about a year and a half ago, and that idea was basically that we needed to start not just reaching out to the general public and progressive people, but also that we needed to like have people in our own movements, you know, and not just the environmental or anarchist movement, but beyond the social justice and the political prisoner support community to really recognize Jeff. And so we used this solidarity statement, and the people with Break the Chains political support group were really influential in this. And they've gotten some serious people to sign on. There's Mumia Abu-Jamal signed on, as well as Howard Zinn, Jelly Biafra, a whole host of different authors and people associated with climate change or writing on climate change, like Bron Taylor, people like that. There's so far, I think, about 400 people that have signed on to it. And we've sort of used it as a way of, like, increasing movement support, as well as, you know, potentially being a piece in any campaigns towards Amnesty International or the ACLU and things like that. So there's a lot of people that have spoken out. I mean, obviously a lot of music bands and people like that have spoken out. Clearly, I think like there's a need for people who have an audience to speak out on his behalf. I think former political prisoners have been the most vocal supporters. We have individuals here, you know, in New York City, Ashanti Alston. He's a former political prisoner, has been extremely supportive, as well as the animal liberation, you know, prisoner community and, you know, other political prisoners. There's a lot of people who will come out for our events and speak at our events. And, you know, so far it's been pretty successful, but I think we still need more people that are willing to take a public stand on this issue.
How about other groups in the environmental movement, maybe not so radically inclined, but more ones that lobby Congress? Have they taken any stance on Jeff's case?
It's really hard to say. I don't see much of that. You know, I mean, if you're talking about groups like the Sierra Club and whatnot, what we get from a lot of the mainstream organizations is they attack property destruction. They attack the ELS, for instance. You have, you know, scumbags from the Sierra Club like Carl Pope speaking out, saying that people who start fires to save nature, so to speak, are terrorists. And I think that's sort of just mind-boggling from a person who pulls a, you know, $250,000 paycheck. But no, I can't say that the Gang of Ten or the Group of Ten, you know, biggest environmental groups have been much help. It's kind of odd at times. You expect that if a group worked on climate change that they might take this seriously, but I think it rattles the cages of funders too much. I will say that the radical environmental movement has been extremely supportive of Jeff. You know, Earth First in particular, and the Earth First Network in the U.S. and abroad has been extremely supportive, not only with responding to our, you know, our calls, but just doing the sort of, you know, hard support that we need on like a day-to-day level.
Let's talk a little bit about the role of the media.
Okay.
How has the media been in Eugene, basically the whole world? How has the media been in Eugene and Oregon, nationally in the United States and across the world for Jeff's support?
Well, I think in the early days when they were first getting, you know, prior to the Jeff sentence, you know, typically it was, I find that local media was all involved in like the anarchy scare, you know, like local bomb maker and that kind of, you know, sort of slanted media. The sentence of 23 years made, you know, what the media people call a story, you know, it became a hook. It became something that gave a human side to this case. You know, if Jeff didn't have that sentence, would there be that story? Would people be so willing to listen? Maybe not. But since he had got that sentence, it's much more of a there's a lot more interest in it. It seems like a lot of the corporate media people are completely unwilling to take, you know, risk with stories unless there's some, like, ridiculous aspect to it. And clearly, the sentence is absurd. And so, you know, in some ways, they've covered it very well. The Oregonian and the Register Guard have covered Jeff's case. Those are Oregon-based papers, but not too much. The local Eugene, you know, weekly has been, you know, pretty consistently publishing stories about Jeff since his sentence was imposed on him. The corporate media responded, you know, in sort of a green scare sort of way surrounding the June 12th day of action. That was last year, 2004, when we put out a call asking for people to support Jeff on that day and sort of, you know, sort of like an International Day of Action, but without being maybe so cliche or, you know, without directing people what to do. We kind of left the door really wide open on it, and we said, you know, you do what you feel comfortable. Do what, you know, what you think is the appropriate thing. And people responded around the world with, you know, something like 27 different events in many different cities, including Moscow and Australia and Canada and, you know, all over the U.S. I mean, California had about 5 different events, and there was a huge event in Eugene and things like that. What gave the day the real, like, you know, crazy feel to it was the fact that Fox News basically rewrote an FBI press release warning of eco-terrorist actions that day. Now, if you read the call that we wrote, there's nothing in it saying, you know, go burn something down or, you know, ELF, hey, this is a code for you to go, you know, basically smash something. We wrote a call that we felt was appropriate for basically anyone at any level of support to participate. And so you did have a very varied level of support. We had people that did punk shows. We had film screenings. People in New York City ticketed SUVs all day long. There was massive, you know, big event in Eugene, big event in Brighton, England. Moscow anarchists went and graffitied Free Jeff Lurie on the American embassy, which that was clearly my favorite action, and a lot of us thought that was really great. You know, so we kind of left the door open, but clearly this wasn't like some sort of communique issued by some underground organization. It was, you know, Jeff's support network putting out, asking for support from, you know, international activists. And Fox News ran with this and just created such a hubbub. And at first it seemed really negative, and then we realized that, like, they gave us so much attention. It was unbelievable. I think on June 12th alone, the website got 46,000 unique visitors, which is unbelievable for a website like this, you know, one that focuses on such a narrow issue of one individual. We got an enormous amount of email, some from, you know, right-wing property rights kooks, but mostly from people who we'd never heard from before, who are all too happy to tell us what they thought about the case and donate money and things like that. So, you know, we kind of laughed about it, and some of the groups that were involved in organizing definitely had to deal with some detrimental stuff. For instance, the group in Worcester, Massachusetts had to, they were evicted, actually, from their space because of the pressure the FBI put on their landlord. But some of the, you know, some of the newspapers, like I think it was the Portland Star Tribune in Portland, Maine, basically wrote this whole piece about how this was really ridiculous and that how they spoke to the activists that were planning a show and they said, oh, well, clearly these kids, they're planning a show. They're planning, they're going to play music and have a film and things like that. And, you know, some of the media were really interested in that they photographed the undercover cops that came to the press, really, you know, press conferences. The people in Worcester were smart enough to basically photograph the undercover cars. And the reason we knew they were undercover was because although they had tinted windows, there was like a UPS package addressed to like the Worcester Police Department on the front seat. So there was a lot of that. And there was definitely, I think, crews in California that had to deal with harassment. People in Eugene had business cards left for them from the FBI. So there was a lot of harassment, but the amount of articles, the AP ran with the story, and I think the final count was there were 60 articles in the media that week, which, you know, are they all saying really great things? No. But they're clearly getting his name and the website out, which helps us at least to tell our side of the story. That's the corporate media. I mean, I haven't said much about alternative media. Micro and pirate radio stations were really, really great to us last year. There was a lot of different interviews. I was actually interviewed on Free Radio Santa Cruz last year. We've been reaching out again this year as well to kind of feed into the alternative and independent media movement.
Jeff continues to write from his jail cell and has just released a new zine called Heart Check by himself and Rob Los Ricos Thaxton. How does the Oregon State Penitentiary feel about Jeff's writings?
Hard to say. I don't know really what they know about Heart Check. I imagine they'll know soon because I think we're going to be sending it to those two. It's unlikely that it's going to get in. I think there's a really kind of provocative photo or artwork on the front of a Molotov cocktail and a young, seemingly young, masked individual with a slingshot aiming at a riot cop line. So I don't know, you know, if it's going to get in, but they're pretty aggressive to Jeff. They go on, you know, they're aggressive at times, and other times they don't care. In 2003, Jeff was thrown in the hole for writing a letter to the Earth First Journal, and he was in there for about 17 days, and there was a sort of a threat of legal action, and we kind of called them on their behavior, and they let him out of the hole, gave him back his good time. Right now, I think he's engaged in a struggle to actually get some of his artwork sent out of jail. They keep claiming that artwork he is sending out is somehow compromises the safety of the Oregon Department of Corrections, which is doesn't really make much sense, but most of what they do doesn't make sense, and they don't really even try to make sense. They pretty much have very clear you know, amounts of power, and they're willing to exploit it, basically, at any cost. The other situation with the Oregon Department of Corrections and Jeff is that CNN very much wants to interview Jeff, and they wanted to bring video cameras into the prison and document, you know, his life, basically. And there's a precedent for this in that an Australian film crew was in there in 2001 and ended up doing a really great documentary on basically mainstream television in Australia called Green with a Vengeance. That was really, you know, good stuff. And, you know, it didn't exactly portray the FBI in a good light because they were telling the truth. And so this is a very fair and balanced story. And there has been other people. There's been journalists from Switzerland, I believe, and Details Magazine and the Oregonian. And so there's a precedent of the media being allowed in to speak to Jeff. The current, you know, executive assistant or whatever his position is has said that CNN can come in, but they can't come in with a video camera. And they're saying that the reason that is because it will somehow elevate Jeff above the stat, you know, into like a, you know, kingpin or different like status amongst the other prisoners, and that could put him at risk. But the bottom line is that they've already allowed publications in to take photos of Jeff, and publications that are allowed into the jail, like Details and the Oregonian. So it doesn't really make much sense, and it seems really more vindictive than anything. So currently we are trying to see how we can end up getting a video camera in there anyway with CNN, and I think CNN's going to be in Eugene at the beginning of June to cover events and at the minimum go in there with audio and interview him. So that should be really great. I mean, obviously it'll expose him a lot of people. But when we're talking about doing CNN, that's TV, and without video, TV is kind of dry. So it's not too great. But yeah, we don't really know what they think of Heart Check. For all I know, they, you know, writing a prisoner writing a zine that's published could be illegal according to their arcane rules. I don't really know. And we really don't care that much. I mean, we're not going to allow Jeff to be silenced, and we're going to continue to publish his writings and his artwork and things like that until he gets out.
I would love to hear from Jeff. Could you please read us an excerpt from Heart Check?
Sure, I'll read the dedication. That's really short. So this is from the Heart Check Zine. This zine is dedicated to all the brave warriors who have died struggling for freedom and to all of our imprisoned friends and comrades who have lost what little freedom they had struggling for land and liberty. You are not forgotten. With each act of resistance, your memory lives on in our hearts. The winds of change are blown again, and they are pushing against our backs. The winds are pushing us forward and howling, fight back. Up the rebels, Jeffrey, free Lures. We've just put out the zine, Heart Check, and it's writings by Jeff Lures and another anarchist political prisoner, Rob Los Ricos Baxton. And it's available for our website, which is freefreenow.org. People can also get it online. They can buy single copies from Clamor Magazine, and their info is clamormagazine.com, and you can click on Info Shop. As of next week, people will be able to order single or multiple copies of Heart Check from AK Press as well. Their contact is akpress.org, and they're based out of Oakland. Single copies are available for $7 from our post office box in Eugene. That's postage paid. It's post office box 3, Eugene, Oregon, 97440. And if you send a check or money order, you can make it out to Free's Defense Fund. And then multiple copy prices are really good. If you buy 10 copies, they're only $4 a piece. And that's sort of a deal that we were given to, you know, distributors and info shops and things like that. It's a really nice zine. It's printed on 100% post-consumer recycled paper. It's got a, like, four-color cover, and it's about 45 pages. And it contains about 10 articles by Jeff and Rob and some artwork and things like that. And I highly recommend it. And the zine is a benefit, 100% a benefit for Rob and Jeff. I mean, outside of the cost of printing, all of these funds are going to be going to these two individuals and whatever it is they want to do with it, most likely legal defense in Jeff's case, and a release fund of some kind for Rob, who gets out next year.
I know there's a lot of ways that people can help with this case. Can you summarize some of those ways?
Sure. There's a lot of different ways. Some of the ways are basically on the website, freefreenow.org. Check, you know, you can visit there, read Jeff's writings, check out his artwork and photos. You can download audio files, learn more about the case, so some of the different interviews we've given over the years. You can hear some of, you know, songs written about Jeff and things like that. If you go to freefreenow.org, we have a listserv that we use. It's an announcement-only listserv that doesn't give many messages out, but when we do give out a message, it's usually pretty important. That's on the main page of Free Free Now. You can sign the solidarity statement. That's also available online. It's basically a short statement just stating that, you know, you and your organization or just your individual self support Jeff's appeal and really want him out of jail and point out the political aspects of, you know, his sentence and his so-called crime. You can email us at freefreenow@mutualaid.org if you want to, you know, basically sign that statement. Another big thing, and this is always rough, but we need a lot of donations. Like the audio that you played before said, you know, Jeff's original trial cost nearly $20,000. And his appeal right now is being covered by a public defender, but at his next appeal, we're going to have to pay a lawyer $15,000 to start, and it could be potentially much more than that. It's remarkable, actually, how much money is needed for this sort of work. You know, a sticker order can cost something like $600. Printing the zine costs over $1,000. The website takes, you know, very little money because it's all, you know, our whole project is all volunteer-run. You know, donations are needed basically to get Jeff envelopes and pens and books and, you know, whatever it is he needs to get from the commissary. If people are interested and they want to buy him a book from Amazon or AK Press, they can totally get in touch with us through the website, and we can give you a list of books that you can get. And we always ask that people ask Jeff or ask us what he wants to read before sending stuff, because I think he gets his fair share of unsolicited things that he may have read already and things like that. You know, donations could be made out to Free's Defense Fund and sent to P.O. Box 3, Eugene, Oregon, 97440. And if you want, you can also make a donation on our site through PayPal, or you can go to the Clamor Info Shop and, you know, just search Jeff Lures, and there's also a donation button on that site as well. But I really, you know, I suggest that people go to the website. There's tons of different information about Jeff and other political prisoners on there. And I guess finally, one of the main ways people can get involved is the June 10th to 12th weekend of resistance. That's happening, you know, it's little over a month right now. And, you know, like I was talking about the June 12th day of action just before, that was last year. This year we have a very similar thing, but we kind of made it over the weekend so that people can schedule events or maybe even do multiple events. And as of right now, we have events planned in, I believe, about 15 different cities. In North America, there's a very large event in Eugene, Oregon on Sunday, June 12th, which will be a former political prisoner and Earth Firster Peg Millett will be speaking. Peter Urban from the Irish Republican Socialist Committee will be speaking, and there'll be some music as well. In New York, there's going to be a big event with former Black Liberation Army political prisoner Shanti Alston, former ALF prisoner Andy Stepanian, and music by Casey Neal, Cypher, and the Rude Mechanical Orchestra. For Californians, it might be more relevant that there's going to be events taking place in San Francisco all weekend. There's Friday night's Critical Mass Bike Ride will be a bike ride dedicated to Free. And there will be, I believe, a screening of the new film 22/8, The Jeffrey Lurie Story, on either Saturday or Sunday. There's events in Portland, Maine, Cincinnati, Ohio, Los Angeles, California, and Montreal, Quebec. And internationally, there's events in Brighton, England, Melbourne, Australia, Turku, Finland, Leeds, England, Edinburgh, Scotland, and Moscow, Russia. And this page on our site of June 10th to 12th events will be updated pretty much daily as we're finding out about more and more events taking place around the world. So if you're interested in planning an event and you need stickers or videos and flyers, you can definitely contact us at freefreenow@mutualaid.org. People can get in touch with the San Francisco Friends of Jeffrey Lurie, and their email is freejeffreylurie@resist.ca. Of course, if you don't write that down, you can always get in touch with us through the website freefreenow.org. And people in the Northwest, the U.S., can get in touch with the group Break the Chains. They're an excellent prison group. And their website is breakthechains.net, and their email is breakthechains02@yahoo.com.
And I'm running a little bit out of time. I wanted to give you a chance for some final thoughts, but I was also curious about you, Dylan, and your passion for supporting Jeff. How long have you been friends?
Sure. I've been friends with Jeff for a little over 5 years. I knew him from Eugene, where we both lived in the late 90s. I was friends with him. I knew him from the neighborhood, and I always really liked him as a person. We got really close in probably a year after he was in jail, and we've been corresponding and doing work together since then. My belief is that, political prisoner support is really important, and when you support political prisoners, what you're doing is you're laying a groundwork for a really strong movement. And I think it can be sometimes a thankless job, or even a job that, a work that doesn't feel very productive, because you're at the end of the day, when I go to bed, my friend's still in jail, and the people that I do support, I've done political prisoner support for about 7 years, and they ultimately get out, and you can, help them get on with their lives. But there's a lot of negative stuff that you have to deal with. And, some of the struggles with, doing support for an eco-defense prisoner like Jeff has been that, working with people whose minds are changing a little slower about the, validity of the eco and animal liberation struggles. And that's always really hard. And, I think we've made really great headway working with social justice activists and anti-imperialist activists, people that do support for political prisoners and prisoners of war in the last year or two, whereas, they're starting to see that this is real, this is very valid, and, we all live on one planet that's pretty consistently under attack from, capitalism and whatnot. I think political prisoner support basically translates into support for direct action, because people will be way more apt to, basically take direct action and to defend what needs to be defended if they know that there's actually support networks out there, and not, that they're not just going to slip through the cracks like a lot of the political prisoners from the 1970s and early 80s have, which I think is really tragic. So, it's part of what I do, and I think that most anarchists, or all anarchists and activists, need to be involved in some capacity in prisoner support, or supporting people that are facing prison or things like that, because I think that anywhere you go in the U.S., you're going to find something quite relevant to you. Someone, there's jails everywhere, and, there's over 2 million people in criminal supervision in this country, and I think that's really tragic that, they're really out of sight, out of mind, and I think we have to deal with that.
Are people being encouraged to take direct action, like Free and Critter?
Well, I think that people are being encouraged to do what they want to do, which may sound like a riddle, but what I'm trying to say is that, we're not this committee that just sits down and tells people what to do. We're asking, and will be written in this year's call and last year's call, is that people do what they feel comfortable doing. Their level, of activity should be based on what they feel comfortable doing, not what we want them to do. And that basically just people reflect on, whether or not this action that they decide to do would hurt or harm Jeff. And that goes for you know, having a bake sale in an extremely hostile, you know, environment, or deciding to burn SUVs and dedicate the action or something like that. You know, I think people just need to reflect on that. And if they want to go ahead and, you know, take direct action, I think that's appropriate. But, you know, just consider the implications of your actions. And I think if you look at a lot of what Jeff has written, he said very much, like, consider the implications of what you're doing. Consider that, you know, the second you light that fire, you're pretty much, you know, that's a very serious thing. And so I always think people should take direct action seriously and not just go willy-nilly into harm's way. That goes for any, you know, action that we do, and just consider whether it'll help the prisoner that, you know, you're trying to help.
Do you have any final thoughts today, Dylan?
No, I just want to thank you for having me on. It was just always so much to cover. But, you know, basically, if people want to get involved, you know, in Jeff's case or other cases, I think that, you know, there's plenty of prisoners out there that need help. I know in California there's this new group, California Anarchist Prisoner Solidarity, CAPS. They just had a benefit for Jeff in Santa Cruz, so people were really interested in that, and you should definitely look them up. I think their email is caps@riseup.net. But yeah, there's plenty of work that needs to be done, and anyone that's interested in working on this campaign anywhere in the world should really contact us at freefreenow.org.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks so much for having me.
All right.
Bye.
Take care.
Grew up in the land of houses and rows. I had asthma, that's how it goes. When you're in LA, there are cars everywhere. See the sky and smell the air. I left home, looked around, trying to find some solid ground. I found life in the northern wood, and I knew that this was good. I saw the dozers, the death machines, tearing apart everything green. I built a platform, sat in a tree, said if you're taking her down, then you're taking down me. I saw the highways, I saw the mall, I saw the eagle, heard the clarion call. The voices of reason were talking to me, so I burned down a couple of SUVs. 23 years. Among the words and the deeds, war for the West, a chapter was written, and I was the test to shut us all up and drive us apart. All who have life and love in our hearts. The judge did the math, and he did some more. He was a man out to settle a score. An illegal sentence in a stolen land, with life or death in the palm of his hand. 23 years. 23 years. And now here I am, so long behind bars, for trying to breathe in a nation of cars. Sanity jailed and madness in power. Our time it is short, and now is the hour. So may you hide in the darkness, stay safe in the night. Find whatever you need to stay in the fight. There's a planet at stake, and that's all I see. And my thoughts will be with you until I am free. In 23 years. 23 years.
Stop my
just forgets. He's gonna choke on his harmonica outputs.
Thank you for tuning in to the May 16th, 2005 Indie Newswire show on Free Radio Santa Cruz 101.1 FM, freakradio.org, and beyond. This show has been dedicated to Jeffrey Lurz and the June 10th through 12th weekend of resistance.
With Bush seeking near dictatorial powers and our city facing a siege of gentrification, now is the time to join the fight. In Bolivia, protesters fought and won two street wars over water and gas privatization and forced the president to step down. The ruling class fears that this phenomenon will spread to other nations.
How is this possible?
In Bolivia, the IMF and World Bank did pretty much the same things the control board and Congress did here in D.C. The difference wasn't in what the enemy did. The difference was in what the people did. People got out in the streets. People stood up and fought. These programs and the president behind them were defeated. Here in occupied Washington, we have the same capabilities. It begins by refusing to sell your home to a developer. It begins by refusing to sign up to the military, and it escalates to direct action in the street. Enough, and we can force Mayor Williams from office, just like the president of Bolivia. Enough, and we can force Bush the enemy of the free peoples of Earth from his office, just as the president of Bolivia was forced to step down. How is this possible? You make it possible. Get in the game. Join the fight. This is WSQT Guerrilla Radio, broadcasting on 87.9 FM from the heart of occupied Washington. Wow.